Welcome back to Lecture 10. This is second last lecture, and we are remarkably enough on time, so we needn't scamper too much. Now, where we got to last time was I got as far as revisiting the equivalence principle, and in the specific form that if I find the right slide. All free-falling and non-rotating laboratories are fully equivalent to the performance of all physical experiments, and the stronger version of that saying that any physical law that can be expressed in tensor notation in special relativity has exactly the same form in a curved space-time. And this, in a sense, is why we've been talking about, why we've been obsessing about geometry, because the aim is to articulate physical laws in geometrical form, and what this tells us is that once we've done that, we can immediately import that into a curved space-time. So we know, for example, well, Newton's law tells us that F equals ma, that if you exert a force on something, then the acceleration of that object is in the same direction as the force and proportional to it. Detail, the constant of proportionality is the mass, but the geometrical aspect of that is the important thing. That's a geometrical law. That is true independently of the reference frame you pick, independently of the coordinates you pick. It's as true in Cartesian coordinates as it is in polar coordinates and spherical coordinates and anything you like. It's a geometrical law. We can similarly do things in special relativity. We can say the full momentum is conserved in collisions. So the total P before and the total P afterwards are equal. That's a geometrical law. You know, the P before and P after are in the same direction and the same length. And this is telling us there are no further complications. So if we pick a local inertial frame, a free fall frame, then we can do our physics in SR, and that so works. The key thing that this excludes is curvature coupling. There are no extra terms which appear in your geometrical law which are associated with the local curvature. It's not that F equals ma plus a bit depending on r. So this version of the equivalence principle specifically rules that out. It explicitly rules out any other additions to your physical laws. And so that is by itself a physical statement. So I think I've repeatedly distinguished physical statements from mathematical statements. Mathematical statements are things that follow from other things. They cannot be false. Physical statements are things that might be false. You could imagine a universe where that wasn't true. But in this universe, the guess that physical statement is true is a guess, which turns out to be confirmed by experiment. But it has to be confirmed by experiment, because it could be otherwise, but it's not. So this is a physical statement in the sense that you could imagine a universe where that wasn't true, but it's importantly, it is true in our case. And that immediately tells us at least one thing, because in special relativity, we understand how we move. If we just stand here, I just stand here in a reference frame in which I'm stationary, that's sort of the simplest motion you can imagine, me not doing anything at all. What is my movement through space-time? I'm moving along my own time axis. Okay, I'm just standing here moving along my time axis, ticking out the seconds until death. You know? So it's not complicated. And if I were to be, if someone were to be moving past me, and I'm in a reference frame, a natural reference frame, a special relativistic reference frame, moving with respect to them, then my motion, my world line, will be along my local time axis. In other words, it would be a time-like straight line, or which is in Minkowski space, a geodesic. So the geodesics of Minkowski space are various, but there are some which are time-like, our physics, our understanding of the physics special relativity says we move along the time-like geodesics in an initial reference frame, and we do so in a curved space-time as well. So this is telling us half of the famous slogan. Ah, free-falling particles move on time-like geodesics of the local space-time, the slogan being, space tells matter how to move. And this was a famous couplet of, I think, Wheeler, I think, first enunciated it, put it this way. Space tells matter how to move. This is the point at which we have, to some extent, got rid of gravity. This is saying that once you have a curved space-time, the motion within it is simply geodesics. There's no need for a gravitational field. You just follow a geodesic in your field and you're sorted. Job done. So that's the second half of the problem. Once you've set the problem up and got a metric, a solution to Einstein's equation, you've got a solution to start that sentence again. Once you have an answer to the question, what is the metric of the relevant metric of the space-time, you know what happens next. So the first half of that question, though, is how do you work out what the metric is of a space-time in relevant circumstances? So what is the constraint that we have to put in that? And that's what we're going to talk about just now. So the relevance of this, the point being made here, can I make that? I think I can make that full screen. Second, a little bit, get some distractions away. The relevance of this is that, although I didn't spend much time on it, I in passing earlier mentioned that it's when you look at the energy momentum tensor, the team you knew. There was a continuity condition which said that the derivatives of the energy momentum tensor had to be zero, and that's just a consequence of what goes into a box. Plus what's in there is what you end up with. It's a straightforward continuity condition. And that we worked out in a limited circumstance, in a local inertial frame. But what the equivalence principle is telling us is that. We can put a dot on that. If you like it, you can put a dot on it. It's saying that this law that was a special relativistic law is no more complicated in GR. So that also becomes a truth in GR, that the covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor is zero. It's conserved in covariant terms. That's the remark about things moving along time-like geodesics, and the summary of that. So just to recap that, from equivalence principle is a variant of the equivalence principle we talked about in lecture one of the course, basically, if you're thinking that far back. There is more content to that than the versions of the equivalence principle that we talked about last time, but only because we have strengthened it a bit by talking about specifically curved space times and so on. But it's the same idea, and the previous version, the immediately previous preceding version of the equivalence principle that I mentioned, is just equivalent to what you learned in lecture one. Physical laws in flat space time take the same form in a local inertial frame, and that's also called the comma goes to semicolon rule, for the fairly obvious reason that here we're going to turn this comma straight into a semicolon. Okay? So we hear that the comma goes to semicolon rule, that's what we're talking about. It's just a nice way of a nickname for it, if you like. Or space tells matter how to move. Once you've got your space, then things will move along geodesics and problem solved. So we've solved the second half of this problem first, in a way. And what this means is that we have to rethink the way that we think about gravity. Because we are used to standing still being the natural order of things and falling out of trees being the odd thing. We're apes. We spent millions of years, working out how to hold on to trees and not fall out. It's a thing. We have a focus on that. But we are thinking of it the wrong way, this says. We shouldn't be thinking of that. If you imagine a sort of shadow version of us, dropping through the floor, as the floor suddenly disappeared and they dropped down toward the center of the earth. We would see that ghost version of us disappearing at an increasing speed. There would be quotes, strictly in scare quotes, accelerating away from us. And we think, oh my God, that's terrible, they're accelerating. But the correlative principle tells us we are looking at that the wrong way around. That, if you like, that version of us plummeting towards the center of the gravitational, local gravitational concentration is the natural motion, that's the real thing. And we are the ones being accelerated away from that motion by the presence of the floor. So what the floor is doing in this picture is stopping us joining that ghost version of us in free fall and accelerating away. So as our feeling, the pressure on our feet or on the legs of our chair isn't just a bit like a force or acceleration. The force of gravity isn't just like a force of acceleration. It is an acceleration. And so this seems slightly equivocatory, but in a sense, if you think about the right way, then it's clear what that is accelerating us away from. And so this picture of the observer in free fall and the observer not in free fall, you could either view this as being out in space, and this person, and they're both out in space, but this person is on a platform which is accelerating, or else you can regard them as standing on Earth, and this person is on a platform, this person is falling down, and they are equivalent. And in a sense, the physical statement I want to really get over to you, but it's just repetition, is that. Any questions about that? I think I've done that to death. It's just so nice to be able to make a physical statement in this course, rather than just here's more maths. I think I'd rather indulge it. Okay. So the question then becomes, how do we work out? How do we constrain what that metric of space-time should be? And again, this will involve a physical statement, a statement about the universe which could be false. So we have to guess. Or we don't have to guess, because Einstein did the guessing on our behalf. So that guessing, I think, happened more or less over the summer of 1915. So he'd done a lot of the work to sort out the maths of this, to learn the maths of differential geometry over 10 years. You think you had to tough over 10 lectures. He took 10 years from 1905 to 1915 to sort that maths out in his head. He claimed he never understood it, really. But it's only at the end, in a sense, that he did the guesswork to work out what the constraints were on the space-time. And where we start is by going back to Newton. And this is Poisson's equation. This is it's essentially the Laplacian of the gravitational field. Yeah, is that. So the curvature of that gravitational field, essentially, this is just the Newtonian gravitational field, is governed by the density of mass, the local density of mass, and big G, Newton's gravitational constant. So that's a statement of Newton's law of gravity, if you like. Not in a way that Newton would recognize, but it's Newton, that's Newton's law of gravity. From that, you can deduce F equals GMM over R squared. Okay? And we can take that, and the vacuum version of that is similar, except obviously with no mass. So the shape of the gravitational field when there's no mass is, well, it's not complicated. It's just flat. There's no gravitational field. And we can take that as inspiration for what to do next. Because, okay, I just got a quick question, just to at least give us a brief pause for thought. What does this phi, comma I represent? The diagonal of a tensor there to this contraction or this construction here? Who would say it was the first one? Who would say it was the second one? Who would say it was the third one? Quite a lot of thought wasn't there. Have a brief chat, just to... this isn't saying you're wrong, just have a brief chat. let's, you know, chatting is always brief, but so the diagonal of that of a tensor, this contraction here, the third drilling. I see a lot of indecisions there still, but it's not a big deal. But it's is it just this contraction? It has to be the contraction because in the case of this third one, we'd end up with two I's at the bottom, if you like. So it has to, in order for the there to be a correct term with a sum over it. It has to be this contraction here. So there's a contraction over those hard to pick out J's there. So I mentioned that just because it's new. It's about time for a quick question, but also because it looks a bit strange that you haven't previously seen commas upstairs, if you like. So that's that notation looks slightly strange. Okay, so come back to that in a moment. So we have Poisson's equation, I, comma, I equals 4 pi g rho, and phi, comma, I equals 0 in the vacuum. Now, we can look back a bit, and again, lecture one, who knew lecture one was going to be so significant? We can find our thing in lecture one, which described the, you know, you possibly remember this. Idea of the objects falling toward Earth and getting closer without experiencing any acceleration. And we found an expression for that, which where the I mentioned this and sort of showed the result without sort of working through it step by step because the details are sort of fairly obvious once you walk through them, but it wasn't worth delaying, which was G M over R psi. Which also, jumping a few steps here, is also not very neat psi. That's better. You can also squint. Okay. That is the that's what the second derivative of this looks like. I'm sort of missing a couple of steps in the middle here, but the point is. The point is less the details of that than that we can get an expression for something that makes sense in our in a Newtonian picture, which reminds us of the expression we got last at the end of the last chapter, which had you, what was it? Which was the expression for geodesic deviation, which involved the Riemann tensor. And the point of this. One can go through this argument in more steps, but the point of this is that this is suggesting, hinting to us, that the thing that corresponds to this derivative here is something to do with the with contractions of the Riemann tensor, and in particular. Possibly to do with the Ricci tensor, which is that particular contraction of the Riemann tensor. And so one can guess, is the analog of this vacuum equation something nice and straightforward, like R alpha beta equals zero. Does that count as an analog in GR of this vacuum equation? And the answer is yes, it does, sort of. So that is, we're only at the halfway stage here, but that is true in the sense that does boil down to those are the vacuum field equations for GR. So that the shape of the, if in a universe with no energy momentum in it, the possible shapes of the metric are ones where the curvature, the Ritchie tensor sort of curvature is zero, which sort of makes sense. No mass, no curvature. Because that's not surprising, therefore. But we're still not there. One thing we can do is we can add to, since it's also true that if R alpha beta is zero, that would imply also that G alpha mu R mu beta would be equal to zero, trivially. So that implies also that G mu nu equals to R mu nu plus minus a half R G mu nu equals zero. So I haven't added any, this is equivalent to that, because if that's true, then this must be true. But the point is, I'm knowing what's coming here, and I've just switched from R to the Einstein tensor G, for reasons which are at this precise point obscure. So that's the vacuum field equations. What are the? But we're not interested in that. What we're interested in is the field equations in the presence of energy momentum. So you've got a star. You know, what's the field around it? Is that a question? Yeah.
Can we immediately assume that the G will be the Euclidean G?
No, because I think that I think we cannot. No, because I'm not 100% positive about this, but I think there would be non-Euclidean Gs which would have that property. I'm not sure what they would look like offhand, but I think the answer is probably yes, but I don't think that completely constrains that.
Yes,
I think actually it might. I mean, I'm hedging here because I'm not 100% sure, but I think I'm fairly confident that you're right. That it's probably the only solution of that is the Euclidean one. So I think that would be the case, and possibly for that extra auxiliary reason. So a guess for this, for instance, in the vacuum, in the field equations in the presence of matter. So a guess, if this is sort of right, is to say, well, how about saying that R mu nu equals T mu nu, where T is, you remember, the energy momentum tensor. Okay, that's plausible. As a first step, that's sort of plausible, or sort of some proportional to that, some kappa. Now, but the conservation law that we saw here will then tell us that so T mu nu semicolon nu equals zero would then imply that R mu nu semicolon nu was equal to zero. Okay, that might be the case, but that would also imply that when we contracted it, that the curvature scalar was also had a zero derivative. And that tells us that there's no curvature at all, basically. And why...
The third one or the second one?
The answer is the second one.
The second one?
Yeah. So. Yeah. So if the so if the curvature scalar is has zero derivative, then that is essentially saying that the universe is flat. And since the that would in turn mean that the contraction of G U alpha T alpha U going to U, which is equal to zero, that would in turn tell us that the universe had constant density. So this possibility can't be right, because the conservation law of the energy momentum tensor ends up leading us to conclude that the universe has constant density, which is not the case. Universe is lumpy. So this can't be right. It's clearly not far wrong. We're clearly on the right track, but this can't be right. But we have been hinting at the right answer here, because I picked this as an apparently trivial deduction from the Ricci tensor, from the plausible vacuum field equations. So what we can, the next guess, the next step up, is to guess that that is a plausible version. So not the Ricci tensor being proportional to the energy momentum tensor, but this construction, the Einstein tensor, this constructed from the Ricci tensor, being proportional to the energy momentum tensor. And that is plausible, because we know from one of the contracted Bianchi densities that g mu nu is equal to zero as a mathematical identity based on the properties of the Riemann tensor. So the conservation law is satisfied mathematically by this. So that's plausible, and it's right. It turns out to be matched by reality. And this equation here is Einstein's equation. And what I've given you is not a mathematical deduction of it. I'm saying what I've said earlier on. It's not a mathematical deduction of it. It's a guess. It's a plausible guess that we have motivated by analogy with Poisson's equation. It's a guess that Einstein made eventually after several goals in the summer of 1915 and published in the famous paper of 1915. And that is the physical statement on which all of the solutions that follow have been based, and on which all the tests of GR have been based. So the tests of GR, GPS satellites, gravitational waves from slowing down neutron stars and so on, are tests of that guess. And it's passed every single one so far. So there, we can just look at that. That's the true thing, and that is the thing we can all look at and admire and put on T-shirts. Now, that is a tensor equation. So it's a geometrical thing, but we've quoted it in component form. T is a symmetric tensor, as we reassured ourselves last week, which means G is also a symmetric tensor, which means it has 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 independent components. That's 10, because if it's a symmetric tensor, then as a matrix, it's a symmetric matrix. Symmetric and not anti-symmetric, so there are 10 independent components in that. The contracted Bianchi identities add four, count them, mu equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 2, 3, count, add four constraints to that, bring this down to six independent constraints. And the remaining degrees of freedom are based on the fact that we can rescale the coordinate functions as we wish. We can measure in feet rather than meters, or rotate our axes. So this ends up constraining the solutions as much as we need. Because remember, think back, unpack this, that G, Einstein tensor, is composed of the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor, it depends on the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor depends, at least the local inertial frame, on derivatives of the metric, and in particular second derivatives of the metric. So this is a collection of second order of 10 plus constraints, 10 second order differential equations in the components of the metric. The metric has, it's also an isometric tensor, so it also has 10. I said all that in a slightly wrong order. This has 10, it has 10 constraints, four of which are taken up by, accounted for by these. If we want to, it's a differential equation for the components of the metric, a second order differential equation for the components of the metric. It adds six constraints, so there are four degrees of freedom left unconstrained. They are taken up by the freedom we have to change our coordinates in length and orientation. So this is what this does is it constrains the metric. So the metrics that are allowed around our source of energy momentum are those which satisfy that equation. And those are the so-called solutions to general relativity. Doing so is not trivial because you have 10 simultaneous differential equations to solve. But if you symmetrize the problem enough, then you can solve that problem. The first predictions of which came out of GR were Einstein's in sort of 1914, 1913, I believe. But they were based on the gravitational redshift that we talked about briefly last in lecture one again, you know, the idea that as a photon climbs through a gravitational field, it changes frequency, and to the extent that frequency is a type of clock, that means that time moves differently at higher. And the Schulze photon argument said that time moved differently at a higher gravitational potential from at a lower one, and you can deduce from that a version of the metric of a weak field space time. Which is what you, and from that you can deduce things like that there will be some deflection of starlight as it goes past a large mass. But I distract myself because that, although it's significant and historically significant, and was one of the things that the famous Eddington-Dyson measurement of the solar eclipse aimed to rule out, it's not by itself a solution of Einstein's equations. So what are the solutions of Einstein's equations? We can, I think, I think we're actually going ahead of time here, so I think we can, we'll move on. We may even finish early next week. But before I do move on to the first simple solution of this, are there questions on what we've done so far? Are you happy or perplexed? Or a question there. Well, two questions here, okay.
So here this implies that the density is constant, but why does it not imply it?
So the question was, how does this imply that density is constant, but this doesn't? I think the answer to that is that if you stick to just that, then that's a function of second derivatives of the metric. So that's a constraint on second derivatives of the metric. But the mathematical remark that the energy momentum tensor, that the energy momentum is conserved, if this is true, forces the Ricci tensor to be to be conserved as well, if you like, which in turn implies that the curvature scalar is conserved, and the other. But if that's true, then this contraction, if that's true and that's true, then this it can be written as this contraction of the energy momentum tensor having a zero covariant derivative, since G is I think I'm slightly missing a step here. I think we're going around in circles at this point. Okay. I think I may have a comma misplaced. There's a careful description of this step in the notes, but to the question of why does this it's going to annoy me. Why does this make, given they got the argument right, why does this make predict that the universe is constant density and this one doesn't? I think it's basically because there's this extra freedom in here. So if that's zero in a vacuum, then you have the extra freedom of changing G, if you like, without changing the Ricci tensor. This is a rather hand-waving argument, but simply because that's a more complicated object, I think, is a slightly more complicated object. This argument that the energy momentum tensor ends up being constant doesn't work out. Okay, I'm annoyed at that. I'm going to have to go and reassure myself. But, that's a rather hand-waving argument, but I think the key point there is this is simply a slightly richer object, so it has slightly more freedom. You also had a question?
So when you talk back about geodesic deviation,
yeah.
You write on the notes, you write that it's divided over R. I was wondering if R, because I was looking back at the notes, right. Like first set of notes, yeah. And it was divided by Z cubed. And I was wondering if...
Oh, that's maybe just my mistake. Okay, in fact, yeah, yes. When I was writing that up, I thought, that's right. But I think R cubed, it does make a lot more sense because I think that's right. So I think that should be, that probably should be an R cubed there. I'll write it down. Okay. Thank you for that, because that could have been a distraction. Any
You said in the beginning of this section that we can approximate a perfect fluid with a delta function.
Yes, a Kronecker delta.
Yeah. Is that what gives us, is that the only case where we can have one solution to those 10 differential equations? Only perfect fluids, or can you parameterize it further?
I think in that case, jumping back a bit, I think the question, if we go back to basically here, this is the energy momentum tensor, or the components of the energy momentum tensor. For a perfect fluid, which we have, and we persuaded ourselves of that, because we had to, the answer we guessed there has to be independent of what direction we're facing, what we're picking on. So that isn't a solution to anything. That's our input to Einstein's equation. We're saying this is what the energy momentum tensor must look like this. So the only parameter there. Is the pressure, so that the I think this will be well that I think in local inertia frame that would also be a diagonal that would be a diagonal matrix of coordinates in the local inertial frame. Is that what I'm slightly unsure about what you're asking?
You said that the G part of the equation, the left-hand side of the equation of the slide,
yes.
The differential equation.
So yes.
That means that it doesn't mean that they have one solution.
Yes.
But at least in a perfect fluid, since we have a Kronecker of delta, we know that there has to be only one solution to those terms.
Yes, and we won't cover this, but in the case of because this will be covered next in GRG2. So GRG2 is picking up where this leaves off. I will mention a solution of Einstein's equations just because I should show you one, but GRG2 is essentially solutions plural of Einstein's equation. And solution number one that you'll learn is the Schwarzschild metric. And the Schwarzschild metric is the solution to the case where you have a single isolated source of mass. So just a lump of mass in the alone in the universe. And that's a very specific distribution of energy momentum. It's a lump there. And the solution to that is a particular metric, which is called the Schwarzschild solution, which has properties which are of interest. But that is the solution to the case where there's only one dot in your universe. So and jumping ahead of myself, because we have a whole 5 minutes ahead of time, jumping ahead of Dr. Finch, that was Einstein's, the 1915 paper was in November 1915, and Schwarzschild, who was, I think, in the German army at that point, in the middle of the First World War, you know, whiled away his time under shellfire, solving Einstein's equations, as you do. And he did it remarkably quickly, and I think in early 1916, he wrote to Einstein saying, this appears to be a solution. And Einstein went, I thought it would take longer than that. And said, well, that's clearly right. So that's an example of the case where, although you have 10 couple of differential equations, if you make the problem symmetrical enough, and you remove complications by saying we only have one bit of mass, then half of these equations, large chunks of the differential equations of Einstein's equations, fall away, and you're left with much less to solve than you would start off with. More complicated things like other solutions of I'm wrong what I said before, because the free space, the vacuum form of Einstein's equations, which is what that really is, or that, has another solution which isn't a constant flat universe. That solution is gravitational waves. So gravitational waves are a solution to that equation in the presence of no matter at all. So you could have gravitational waves in a universe with no matter at all, because what gravitational waves are is a dynamic perturbation in the metric. This bit of the metric is perturbed, which perturbs the next bit, and that propagates. So that's all gravitational waves are. It's another solution to Einstein's equations in this particular case of a zero right-hand side. A question there. Again?
How would there be a perturbation if there isn't any mass?
Well, the question of how that is started is a different question. That solution says that if, given that it was perturbed, then the perturbation, it's like Maxwell's equations support a perturbation of the electric and magnetic fields. They don't sort of care how that perturbation was started. That's another question, if you like. But they support a perturbation. Good. So that's a fine thing. So and that gives the other half of the slogan. So space tells matter how to curve, how to move. Things move along geodesics. Matter tells space how to curve Einstein's field equations. So you have doubtless seen that slogan in various popular accounts of general relativity, or possibly or whatever. Or you may have heard of this, but that's where those two parts of that slogan are both deep physical statements, expressed in a rather jocular form, but they are both deep physical statements, which you now know the underlying. And that's just a nice picture, really. The point being that once you have a curved space-time, then going in a straight line in that curved space-time can end up producing what, as it were, a view from outside would be a closed loop. Key points. Now, having been ahead of time, I have mocked up the last of the stuff before section 4.3, but section 4.3 is fairly self-contained, and so next time what we'll do is we'll go through section 4.3, which is about doing most of the solution of Einstein's equations minus a chunk of boring algebra in the very simple case of a tiny mass. A tiny central mass, and we discover a nice thing at that point. And at that time is the last lecture. I think it's the Friday of next week that we have the next supervision. This week is it? Friday. Okay, right. In that case, I will. I haven't yet, but I will put up a little heading on the Padlet for supervision 2, and I exhort you to add questions or puzzles or things there. Comment on if someone puts up something which is almost what you want, then add comments, like things. You know, I will use that as the skeleton of the supervision this week. I'll see you then.